a very intriguing conversation we were having. Sorry.
That we abruptly ended.
It was very abruptly ended. That's okay.
Yeah, that's kind of the awkwardness of that. All right, excellent. Well, welcome everyone. And I will go around and say hi to who is here, starting with Bruce and Bob O. Looks like you're outside, Bob. I kind of wish I was. Grant, So-on, Amanda, Phil, Sandy, Bob K, Paulette, Etzido, Mark, Marv, Sydney, Karen, Andy, Joseph, John, Shoketsu, Mary, Vin, Nick, Ken, Abdullah, Pat, Candace, Joan, Coral, Amelia, Angelia, Claudia, and Sabrina. Cool. 32 people. That's great. Yeah, I can't think of any particular announcements. Anyone have anything that I should mention, or do you have questions about anything that's coming up?
Term student next Saturday, right?
Term student retreat is next Saturday, and I think it supplants the regular Sangha meeting. Although, I suppose we could send people who want to check in and they're not part of the term student program, we could just send them off into a breakout room.
Can I say that happened to me in the winter one, and uh-huh. It was a wonderful, wonderful little breakout session. It was so fun.
Oh, cool. All right. Well, we'll plan to do that. So we'll say, well, then the main room here will be in the term. Actually, the term student session should probably go into a breakout room, and then anybody else can show up in the main room. Yeah. And on Tuesdays, we're studying foundational teachings. And in not too long, we will be studying the precepts. And those Tuesday evening classes will be led by people who have in the Sangha who have already received the precepts. So that's always, I just think it's such a great change of pace for y'all to have other people on the teaching seat. And those always prove to be interesting classes. So I guess I will just begin then. So today I am tackling a tricky topic. And right now I might change the name of this, but I am calling this Buddhist teachings, safe spaces, and cancel culture. So I think when we talk about these kinds of things, it's important to remember that we have a human tendency to want to decrease ambiguity and attach to firm opinions. This is the way it is. This is what's right. This is what's wrong. So that we know, right? We can take what's an ambiguous situation and put it in a box, and we're good. We know we're on the side of righteousness, you know, one way or another. So I just want to say, in discussing this today, I'm not intending in any way to give an answer, the right Buddhist answer to these issues, to make it easier to just like, oh, well, I know the right Buddhist answer to this, so now I don't have to think about it anymore. Or that I'm some kind of expert on sociology or social issues or dealing with them or anything. And therefore, I'm giving you the right answer and you need to accept my answer. Just like our precept practice, which we will be engaging in soon, these teachings are never meant to make life easier for us. It's none of the teachings are like, well, now you're off the hook and you've got the answer. They are about how we engage an issue, the kind of the aspirations and principles that guide our behavior. But it's like each situation needs to be dealt with independently. So hopefully this will give some teachings and tools, and maybe another way to frame or approach these issues with some more, what feels like maybe more spaciousness or options, a new perspective. So in Western culture, I mean, it could be wider than Western culture, I don't really know, but certainly in Western culture right now, over the last, I mean, certainly 10, 20 years, you know, the whole evolution has been longer, but we have an increasing appreciation for the experience of others, particularly people or groups who have experienced oppression, trauma, exclusion, pervasive and continued disadvantage, including, and this is just a very short list, right? Women who have had to deal with sexual harassment and even assault in the workplace and not had anything that they can do about that. African-Americans who have had to live with significantly higher fear of being the target of suspicion, arrest, or violence from law enforcement. People who prefer a gender identification other than the one they're born with, and who experience great sadness and alienation at having to live a lie just so the rest of us can remain unchallenged in our assumptions about binary gender. We are trying to become more aware of people who have experienced trauma and how differently they experience the world, and how, you know, situations that for people who haven't experienced trauma don't seem like any big deal. They can actually be quite daunting, and they rarely receive any understanding or sympathy for this. So, you know, these are just a few examples of people. And some of those qualifications may apply to any one of you, but not all of them, right? So there's, no matter what category we fall in, there are other people who we need to start to learn to understand what their experience is like with some kind of empathy and curiosity. And what is that like, and what kind of challenges are you facing? And this is great. It can be uncomfortable, it can be challenging and confusing, maybe at times exhausting, disorienting. But from a Buddhist point of view, it's all good, right? We're challenging our ideas about the world, we're challenging our ideas about ourselves. We are bearing witness. So this is part of that bearing witness practice, you know, what really tuning into and listening to what the suffering in the world and all the forms it takes. And this arouses our compassion and enables us to be more skillful in our bodhisattva efforts to relieve suffering and bring about wisdom and compassion. If we don't understand what someone's going through and we try to help them, we're usually not very helpful, right? We want to include somebody, but we don't understand what their experience is. So this bearing witness to people's experience is great. And our culture is responding to this trend with efforts at education, formal and informal, establishing new standards for the way that we speak, the way that we act toward one another. It has a long way to go. But at least there's a publicly confessed by at least some portion of the population, effort to address prejudice and unfair treatment, bring about more equity. And equity meaning, you know, and I think this is a very strong liberal value, right? Not equality as let's treat everybody the same, but equity in that, I don't know if you've ever seen that little drawing of like, there's a wall and one guy is tall enough to see over the wall. And then there's people of different heights and they can't see over the wall. So they have to stand on a stool or on a ladder, and each one needs a different, you know, height of ladder in order to be able to see over that wall. So that's portrayed as like, that's equity, is making sure everybody has access. And sometimes people don't understand the concept of like safe spaces, thinking it's about entitled white college students. And sometimes it is. But this concept arises from wanting to include people who have needs that are usually ignored or misunderstood by the dominant culture. And in our case, you know, and we may be very unskillful at this, ignorant about this, but at least it's a willingness, it's a desire to share the three treasures of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha with everyone, with whoever comes seeking, and being happy to go the extra mile to make someone feel welcome and appreciated and part of the Sangha. So all of this is great, right? Very like consistent with bodhisattva activity and with practice. Now there's another trend in our society right now, commonly called cancel culture. And it started, they didn't start, I'm sure, with this, but that term at least started with lecturers being canceled on college campuses because there would be an uproar from the students saying, we don't agree with this person's views. They have the wrong kind of views, or they've said or done something in the past we don't agree with. So then the lecture is canceled. But of course, this is spread to where anyone can be canceled, something they've said or done, even if it's in the distant past, and subsequently in the intervening years or decades, they really haven't done anything offensive. But whatever they did is deemed by the liberal members of the public to be unacceptably insensitive to one of those disadvantaged groups. And people's lives get very quickly destroyed. Really, like, they lose their jobs. They can't get another job. They get kicked out of their housing. They get outcast by friends and family. They get vilified. They get attacked. I mean, it's a very real thing. So, I mean, to some extent, right, this is holding people accountable in a new way. And this accountability is enabled almost entirely by social media, right? Like, the news spreads, and then we can enact our judgment and cancel somebody via social media in a way that would have been possible before. Like, maybe you piss off your neighbors, but, you know, who else is going to find out? So then what this means is that people who haven't done anything illegal, at least not in a way that can be proven, so it's unlikely they would have suffered any consequences before, can be called to account. So that's, in some ways, that's a good thing, right? Like, we have the Me Too movement. So there's men that got away with abuse for many, many years, and there's nothing, like, you couldn't catch them. And yet now they're suffering some consequences. So in a way, that's a good thing. But how far does this go? Increasing numbers of people say they hold some political views that they are generally afraid to share unless they're with the right, like, friends. That if you're with some trusted friends, you can say this, but otherwise you better watch it and you hope that nobody's recording your conversation. and there have to be lots of people out there who worry about something that they know that they said or did in the past. And God forbid anyone Pat says, what did I say? I said Buddhist teachings, safe spaces, and cancel culture. you know, that mistakes that we've made in the past that could come to light, and then we will be destroyed. Honest debate is constrained or shut down because certain views or questions are simply unacceptable. I mean, a darling of liberals, and I mean, I'm kind of making an assumption that we're all liberals. I shouldn't, but you know, it tends to be the case in Buddhist sanghas. A darling of liberals is that, you know, people, you know, the circumstances they face in their lives, cultural, economic, the experiences they've had account so much for how they're able to perform, if you will, like whether they're really able to do well at a job or do well in school or be economically successful or something, you know. So we really look at like all the causes and conditions that accounted for a person maybe not doing as well as we might hope. Now, the other end of the political spectrum says, pull yourself up by your own freaking bootstraps. It's not my problem. Like, so it's all about like individual responsibility. And so at either extreme, we're saying, you know, you're kind of just a victim of your circumstances or you're completely responsible. And, you know, I mean, to make some arguments in liberal circles, let's see, it's very distracting when I... examples of folks being ruined in this way. Well, I'd have a terrible memory. If I had a better memory, I could bring it up. I watched Bill Maher last night. This was one of his topics. So I don't have at the top of my examples to do this. I guess maybe pull him up on YouTube and watch it. I don't know if you like him or not, but he does mention quite a few examples of individuals who said something and now they've been kicked off their, you know, kicked off their college campus, etc. So I don't know if anybody else has any suggestions about kind of looking more into this. I thought it was, I kind of assumed that people were pretty familiar with this, but maybe I'm wrong. If anybody does, and I know I just said like the chat is distracting, but if you do know of any articles or examples or something like that, and you want to throw them in the chat, please feel free if you want to share. You know, but it's debatable, like how widespread is this problem? How terrible is this problem? Are there benefits from holding people accountable? Yes. So, I mean, I feel this. I feel this in my climate work. I honestly am prepared to be canceled at some point. And I hope that my sangha won't throw me out if other people start canceling me. But I belong to a particular organization, Extinction Rebellion America, that has chosen a particular set of demands of the government that do not include a particular demand that another group has that is very, very specific about racial justice. So they added a demand to Extinction Rebellion from the UK that it was about reparations and about putting Indigenous voices first and about Indigenous sovereignty. And for us, we say that is what we want to do is empower citizens' assemblies to decide the way forward. And you know, we hope that, yeah, like social justice, racial justice, but that should be up to the people who get put on those citizens' assemblies. And the whole point is that if you make too much of a ideology ahead of time, you can't form alliances with people. Like, are we going to have an argument about reparations before we act on the climate? That's a tricky thing. Even some African Americans are going to argue about reparations. You know, so the more specific we get, the trickier it gets. So we've chosen not to have that fourth demand. And we are called racists. We are vilified. I haven't been canceled personally, but I don't know. Could be a matter of time. I mean, essentially, they have tried to cancel our entire organization and badmouth us and undermine us because we don't have that one particular demand. So we're not meeting that standard, that liberally decided standard of how we should act. And I think it's really damaging, you know, that people have different ways of approaching topics. At the very least, we should be able to talk about it. So the irony is, even as liberals police one another about political correctness with extreme political correctness and cancel culture, those on the other side of the political spectrum are becoming more, even more insensitive in reaction. It's like, if you live and work where you could get canceled by liberals, you'd better be careful about everything you say. But if you're in another area of life, like, you actually gain cred by being by offending liberals, right? So you can say all kinds of nasty stuff. And like, so to some extent, the agenda of extreme political correctness and cancel culture is like not effective in a certain sense. So it's having that polar opposite effect in some ways to what perhaps we hope for. So how do we approach this this conundrum as practice? And practice meaning, you know, living deliberately, trying to make choices that decrease suffering and increase wisdom and compassion. So first, we carefully examine what is going on. And I don't mean out there in society, but within ourselves. So as we encounter this stuff, as we get swept up in this stuff or have reactions to this stuff, what is going on for us? How do we relate to the call for greater sensitivity, consideration, equity? I'm guessing that every one of us has some limit or resistance in this effort. Some group we find it difficult to sympathize with, some accommodation or cultural change that we think is going a little bit too far, some outcry of oppression or inequity we get impatient hearing about. We probably don't like confess this, right? In very many circles, but like, well, I don't know about that one. Or maybe we do, maybe we have some friends that we do, but. So in practice, we cultivate mindfulness, awareness, attentiveness, awakeness about whatever we observe within ourselves without judgment. Now, that's not saying that at some point we don't want to change something. Like, I notice I have a low sense of tolerance for this particular issue. Maybe I should look into it some more. Maybe bear witness and understand a little bit more about what's going on here. So we may choose to do something like that, but in this act of mindfulness, we don't want to leap to judgment, because if we leap to judgment, then we can't see clearly. We can't recognize, oh, that's what's going on. I actually have resistance to that. That's an interesting thing I could look into. But if we instantly feel shame about our bad thoughts or something like that, then we're probably not going to see them clearly. And as we examine ourselves honestly, we probably also find that as we come to understand the perspective and experience of a disadvantaged person or group, that our sense of compassion and responsibility is awakened in a really positive way. It can be disturbing and shocking to recognize how traumatic and painful and lonely and difficult the experience of a fellow human being has been, especially when much or some of their pain has been caused by other people, by our society, by an insensitive and exploitative culture of which we are a part. And especially when we're at least partly culpable for the inequity or benefiting from it in some way, right? So this is, you know, the prime example in our sangha. Periodically, some of us who identify as white end up taking what we call the Awakening to Whiteness series. And it really is an incredible educational wake-up call to the history of racism in our country, but not just the main point of it is not just racism, like, oh, look at that problem other people have. It's talking about, like, this is part of our our being, our culture, our lives have been shaped by this. So it's quite a challenging experience. And then also there's, you know, Zen teachers, I think Shintai, one of the lay teachers that comes to teach here sometimes, has studied some about trauma-informed care. And I have not done that yet, but apparently it is extremely eye-opening to look at your sangha, look at your community or workplace or whatever, through the eyes of somebody who has experienced severe trauma, and how different, like, you have no clue about certain things that are triggering or upsetting or unwelcoming, and to learn about that. And the natural response, right, is to, like, it's not, in a way, it's not about shoulds. It's about, oh no, you know, we don't want people to feel like that. We want people to feel welcome. So once we become a little more informed about this stuff, we often see unfairness and insensitivity and socially caused suffering everywhere. And some of us feel compelled to share what we've learned widely, to call attention to any injustice and insensitivity we see, to view every situation through a new lens, imagining what somebody with an experience of prejudice, injustice, whatever disadvantage they might be feeling in that situation. So I think this is kind of what the term is, like, woke, you know, we're woke about this particular issue. But to be humble, none of us are woke about all the different forms of disadvantage and difficulty that people experience, you know. So we become woke about this thing. And I mean, I totally fall for this. Like, I'm woke about this now, and I want to tell you all about it. And like, but I'm not woke about all the other things. And you may be in a different place in your journey in terms of what you're studying and focusing on. So, but it's kind of natural when we do wake up to this stuff to just be pretty horrified at the ignorance, insensitivity, outright hostility that we witness in friends or family or community members, or God forbid, our public figures and politicians, right? It's just like, oh, you know, you begin to develop a sense of empathy. And when you hear our leaders talk in, you know, completely crude and sensitive ways, it's just like, oh, you know, on behalf of folks. So having awakened our sense of empathy with people who are harmed, it's pretty natural to want to rise up in their defense, to call out offenders and to punish them, to take away their ability to offend again, and to demonstrate to society that this behavior is unacceptable. So, like, I mean, you know, cancel culture kind of comes from a good place in a way, right? I mean, it's like the original intention. This is what we can recognize in our mindful reflection, that whatever place on this spectrum we're experiencing, we can recognize, you know, we're doing our best. There is some sincere feelings behind it. And I think it's valuable to look within and see how we all hold the potential for all the roles in this crazy drama. You know, everybody has the role at times of oppressor and at times the role of victim. Everybody has been disadvantaged in some way, you know, economically, physically, mentally, trauma, gender, sexual identity, religion. And almost all of us are guilty of insensitivity to others and benefiting from the disadvantage of others. And almost all of us have become sincerely woke to some truth. Almost all of us are willing to contemplate canceling somebody if the appropriate situation arises, depending on how offensive we think their behavior has been. So what do we do with all of this? What Buddhist teachings and practices can help guide us? So I'm only going to share a few and then open it up, because I'm sure I could find many, many teachings that are relevant. But what leapt to my mind, and I think this one might be like pretty core, pretty central, and that's the teaching of the middle way. So the origin of this teaching is from the Buddha's story, where, you know, he had lived a life of luxury and he recognized that wasn't, you know, fruitful for his spiritual quest and understanding the nature of life and the nature of suffering. So then he went to the other extreme and he practiced, you know, asceticism. Like it said, I mean, he was going to like starve to death, except that the gods beseeched him to please just eat a little bit. So he just ate just so little that he looked like a skeleton. And so he was doing all this hardcore ascetic practice, but he recognized like he wasn't, that wasn't it either. So then he settled on the middle way, which was neither extreme, right? He took a little bit of food. He sat in meditation the way we do and found another way. So the middle way is not, it's not a compromise. It's a third way. So when there are, seems like there's only two options and there are extremes, the middle way says, no, there's another way. And it's a lively way. It's a way that doesn't have a fixed position. It's a way that's about living each moment, meeting each situation, not having a set plan, but having principles, having a practice and having principles that are going to guide your behavior, but not necessarily a set answer. So the idea is that the extremes on either side are always a trap. They're a delusion, they're missing something, and they're often destructive. So in this case, we're saying we're trying to build greater understanding, sensitivity in our culture, working to change things so society is more inclusive, more equitable. Yay. So that can be a guiding principle. Now the extreme, at one end, of course, is the dog eat dog, each to their own, pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. And those who have power deserve, and money and advantage, deserve it, right? And so they're going to hold on to it. There you go. So that's the one extreme. And the other side, you know, we may think, oh, there can't be another side, the other extreme. When you're talking about, you know, justice and equity and inclusion, there can't be another extreme. Like you can't have too much of that. And to some extent you can't, but there is an extreme that we can fall into. And I would suggest that extreme political correctness and cancel culture is that other extreme, where we've lost the ability to tolerate mistakes, to be patient with people as their views change, as their behavior changes, as they respond, as they resist. So we've lost the ability to discern the difference between insensitive statements made decades ago and a consciously racist act done last year. There's just no differentiation anymore. Each one, you deserve complete cancellation. So the good thing about the middle way teaching is it gives us another option, a third way, not getting caught in either extreme. So we don't need, so we can say like, all right, I can kind of see that, you know, cancel culture isn't great, but does that mean I just have to like roll over and let the other side win? But of course, this is saying, no, definitely not. We don't need to surrender to insensitivity, injustice, exploitation, you know, in any way. but we give up that kind of fixed position. So we dwell in that don't know mind, but not in a don't know, I'm not going to decide or respond or listen mind, but I don't know yet. I don't know that situation yet. I don't know that law yet. I don't know that circumstance. I don't know that person. When I encounter it, then I'm going to see how I can respond, what the best thing would be for building toward greater understanding, sensitivity, equity, etc. And be informed by our bearing witness that we've done, that we've learned about various people's experiences. So another teaching I think is useful, and it's not like we have a teaching called this, but in the teachings, I can pull this out, and I would call it coercion versus conversion. So one of these extremes that we can get caught in is permissiveness versus coercion. So an example is, free speech. Anything goes. Only the most explicit call to violence can be punished. And frankly, I can say pretty explicitly, how about you walk down to the Capitol and stop the steal right now? And that's still not, that's still okay. So you have to be really, really, really explicit, or otherwise you can say anything you want. Versus, of course, then the other extreme is this policing speech through extreme political correctness and cancel culture. Now we know the old saying, sticks and stones will break my bones, but names will never hurt me, is just not true. I mean, we've seen over the last 4+ years, whatever, that speech has a huge impact. that has really changed the our whole culture and made life difficult for so many people. The careless, crude, racist, bigoted speech that came from our leadership over the last 4 years. But let's also be honest with ourselves that, cancel culture is social coercion. It's the modern version of mob justice. And we may feel very righteous about participating in it, or some people may feel very righteous about it. But it's essentially no different than a mob that had felt righteous about hanging somebody that they were sure did it. And then they're going to go out and hang somebody without waiting for the law to address the issue. Is this the only way? What are we trying to achieve? I would say we're trying to achieve a society with less hateful or insensitive speech in this particular case, and then with less oppressive and hurtful behavior that results from that and is encouraged by that. But do we insist on having that society immediately through whatever means necessary? Are we willing to accept the repercussions of using social coercion, which I suggest include the radicalization of the right in reaction? I'm kind of suggesting an answer to that question, but I'm not saying that I'm right about it. Or are we looking to transform our society into a more equitable and compassionate one in the long term? If this is the case, aren't we looking to convert people instead of coerce them? Aren't we looking to spread greater sensitivity, empathy, and understanding in our society so people are willing and able to speak and act in ways that are more helpful and compassionate? Now, the essence of Buddhist practice is about the transformation of individual human hearts, releasing them from the bondage of selfishness and self-concern. But we don't get caught in extremes, right? On the one hand, of course, there is a time and a place for just legislating behavior long before people feel like acting that way, right? If we had waited until everybody felt like giving African Americans civil rights, we still probably would be living in an apartheid society. you know, women had to fight for the right to vote. There's all kinds of examples over our history where people had to, we'd had to bite the bullet and make people do stuff. So, I mean, there's always a balance. We've got to perhaps push people a little more than they're ready to be pushed. But how much coercion? The coercion is unlikely to convert anyone. So there's the middle way. If one extreme is a complete lack of concern and accountability, and the other is social coercion, what's the middle? What's appropriate? What works best in any given situation? So another very helpful teaching, I think, some of you will be familiar with this, is right speech. So this is a little bit like in terms of if we lean toward the I should be able to say whatever I want, which I doubt most people here lean too far in that direction, but you know, I feel a little sympathetic to it. So the five things that the Buddha said to consider before speaking. Is it true? Is it factual and true? Is it helpful or beneficial? Is it spoken with kindness and goodwill? Meaning you have the best interests of people in mind, the people involved. Is it endearing? That is, spoken gently in a way that the person, you know, is ready to hear, won't offend them. And is it timely? Is this the right time? So the interesting thing is it says, basically, then if it's not true, don't say it. if it's true, but it's not beneficial, don't say it. If it is true and beneficial, but not endearing, like it's going to be hard to hear, then we should know the proper time for saying it. So he doesn't say, you know, don't say anything that people don't want to hear, right? But just think about the proper time for saying it. I think that's so subtle. And then let's see, the other ones are, so even if it's true and beneficial and endearing, then you still have the proper time for saying them, because we have sympathy for living beings. So when you think about, I guess, when you think about right speech in this way, you realize it can't be coerced. And again, I mean, there's times for legislation and expectation and social pressure and all that, because, you know, we want to protect people. But on the other hand, if people are really going to be more compassionate with one another, more understanding with one another, more generous with one another, that's not something that can be coerced. That's something we want to encourage people to do. We want to build connections and encourage people to do. And then finally, again, this isn't exactly like what the teaching is called, but just to pull it out, I guess I would say it's non-rejection. As human beings, we're so ready to reject people. I'm involved with activism now, and if somebody is acting in a way, it's, oh, they're a pain in the ass, and they're just so unreasonable, and they're blah, blah, blah. The inclination is like, let's kick them out. Let's not have to deal with them anymore.
Oh, sorry.
And
just move fast.
And then, but so I didn't have a chance. I had to get ready to sit today while I was working on this talk. But a couple examples that I thought of was the Buddha, according to in the Pali Canon, the Buddha met and converted a murderer, Angulimala, who I think he had a mala of fingers from the people he'd killed around his neck. And he converted him, and he didn't like convert him and then, you know, you have to sit on the edge of the Sangha in shame. He converted him. And then he predicted eventual Buddhahood for his cousin Devadatta, who tried to have him assassinated. Our vow as a bodhisattva is to save all beings. And that entails a faith that all beings can be saved. I mean, in this lifetime, somebody may need to be imprisoned throughout. That may be the best thing for society. It's not just a matter of we give up any kind of discrimination or boundary setting. But rejecting people, outcasting people from community, from a Buddhist point of view, should be a last resort, an absolute last resort. Because once you've outcast them, you have no influence over them anymore. You have written them off. So I will open it up for comments and questions. And just to open it up to this kind of topic, you know, has the potential of going down some pretty triggering rabbit holes. You know, so I don't really want to debate the validity of cancel culture or certain examples of, you know, whether things are justified or not. At the same time, I also, you know, we need to, within Sangha, in the interest of not practicing social coercion within the Sangha, and not canceling people, and not is to hopefully we will have the courage to say what we really think, and that people will not reject us for that. I really aspire to have a Sangha where, I don't know, maybe it's a pipe dream, but where somebody could say, well, I don't know about that. I am really, you know, we did have somebody a ways back who said, you know, I frankly don't get transgender. Who cares? Who cares what gender you are? Like, why, what's the big deal? And this person asked this in all sincerity, but it was a kind of risky thing to ask, right? Because in liberal circles now, you're not supposed to say anything, you know, it's all supposed to be just great and that's wonderful and we should, so there's an expectation about what you should think and what you should say and the questions that you shouldn't have to ask. So I really think it's valuable that people have the courage to ask that kind of question and to really say, oh, I'm having some doubts about this, but to maintain that attitude of humility and also not to be too people have particular personal karma sometimes, and they may conclude that the Sangha, like, everybody feels that way and I'm different. So I guess I'll just go away. And I hope that that doesn't happen as well. That if you do have a very different experience or a very different view, yeah, maybe you don't want to speak up in the middle of this discussion and bring it up. Perhaps that's intimidating, but please don't go away. You know, talk to me, talk to other Sangha members you trust, and just, yeah, do not allow our Sangha to alienate you because of what you happen to think or believe. So with that, I'll open it up. Comments or questions or thoughts.
Well, I was, this is Vin.
Yeah.
I was thinking about this. I have some fairly strong views about cancel culture and presentation. And mostly it's tactical, practical. People have a limited amount of attention. And if you ask people to pay attention to too many things, they won't pay attention to anything you have to say because it just gets lost in the noise. Mm. And here in the United States, about half the population, little less than half, 40 some percent something, have some views, political views, that are so different from the other 60% of us that it's very hard to have a conversation because they have their own set of facts, as opposed to just a, here's the facts and we disagree on policy or whatever. And I think about this because I have a friend who has, from my perspective, gone down the rabbit hole. And I really am concerned about how to interact with him without triggering his set of stresses and so forth. And I see this as a big problem because if we have people who have divergent sets of facts, then you can't really have any kind of dialogue. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, it's in some ways easier for me. Having grown up as a Black person, I'm very clear, and it has been very clear my whole life, that my life experience, although very privileged relative to most people's, has been divergent in a lot of ways, and I just can't blurt out all sorts of stuff because I'll just piss people off. And to your original point about climate action, humans are going to behave badly because we're humans, and that's probably going to continue until we're no longer recognizably human or no longer existing. So we need to prioritize. Environmental degradation is an existential threat, from my perspective, to our, not only our civilization, but to our species. So we have to find common ground there and get people to nudge their behavior in the correct manner, in what we consider to be a good manner, to avoid that existential threat. And then, having established some common ground, then maybe we can move on to some other things. But you have to establish the common ground. And because the clock is really ticking on that, on the existential threat to our civilization, I would argue that we need to prioritize that. I'll get off my soapbox now.
Thank you, Vin. Thank you very much. Yeah, it's a, you know, and I don't mean to say, like, and that's the thing, it's like, there's no, you know, hopefully I didn't mean to sound like I was presenting any answers, right? Because you can also lean to the other side of saying, you know, well, it all should be dialogue, and we should try to convert these people who have the alternative facts, and, you know, shouldn't judge them. And what, you know, you said something about like the practicality and the skillfulness. So that's what a bodhisattva does, is like, in this situation, what would be the most beneficial thing? And the most beneficial thing might be to say, y'all are a bunch of idiots. I mean, it's possible. I don't know, that probably not, but like, it could potentially be that you need to like draw the line. I don't know. To make fun of people. I mean, sometimes making fun of people is a way to diffuse things. So like, in a way, none of the tools are off the table. And it doesn't mean that we like, well, let's not do anything offensive or assertive until we can just bring around every last person, you know? So anyway, let's see who, I think, looks like Ken and then Saon.
Thank you. Thanks for your talk, Tom Domio. I don't live in the States, so this whole arising of this thread and this topic, I've only taken in the context of how it pertains to Sangha and Sangha as a safe space. I haven't any experience with what's been going on in the States, really, with these movements. So for me, it has been about how, when the safe space was brought up, from my perspective, it was encouraging us as Sangha members to ensure a safe space for one another, which is great. I mean, I love that. I mean, I put all of my faith in that we've all taken the Bodhisattva vows and that we're doing the best we can to be compassionate towards one another and speak properly. That being said, if anybody has a t-shirt or needs like a mascot for saying things you shouldn't say, like, my face is right here. You can put it on that t-shirt because, like, I say wrong things all the time. I know. But, like, the ironic or the pivotal thing for me is that the reason that I am in this sangha is because I have CPTSD. I have borderline personality disorder. I have all of these things that make me really, really triggerable. If I've said more than 10 words to you, you've probably triggered me. And like, that's, for me, that's valuable. This is a valuable experience for me to learn my dukkha, because my friend told me, nobody said that there's no samsara in a sangha. There's samsara, right? How could there not be samsara in a sangha? There's gonna be grasping. There's gonna be aversion. All of these things are present in life. And if I don't get these opportunities, if everyone's like, oh, Ken, he's super crazy. Don't say anything weird around Ken. He's gonna freak out. Like, then I don't get to learn anything about my own experiences with dukkha. Alexis, shut up. Excuse me. Well, see, there's a classic example. I just don't want people to think that Alice isn't here, so I can't really say anything. But like, I felt her email in that she is hesitant to speak, and even now I'm hesitant to speak in a way that I wasn't before. Maybe I should have been. I don't know. But I think that we should all agree, A, that we're doing the best we can, and it's a safe space, and if we screw it up, it's cool. No dwelling on past mistakes. That may be number 12 or 13 on the list, but it's still on the list. So thanks for forgiving me in advance.
Thank you, Ken. And I think that's an awesome, I mean, it's not either or, you know, it's the middle way. It's not, well, our sangha is the way it is. So if you get triggered and you don't feel comfortable, that's on you. That's your practice. That, you know, that's one extreme. The other extreme is, you know, none of us want to say anything or do anything, and we're all just worried about offending one another, you know, and that's like, that's very difficult as well, right? So like, well, you can meet in the middle, right? We can try, we can learn, we can try to change. But then on the other hand, we also forgive one another and recognize, yeah, Sangha is not going to be, yes. the only way Sangha is different from other places is that we try. We're all agreeing to try. Like, that is really the only, like, we're not inherently any more skillful or compassionate or generous than the average person on the street. We're just aspiring to do better.
Right, and we have a vocabulary that we can work with that frames common ideas that we trust we all share.
So it is 12:17, so if anybody wants to leave, please feel free. But I feel like this is a really valuable conversation. So let's so on.
Yeah, this is a really good thing to view in through a Buddhist lens. And the way I view it is it's a difference between that Old Testament view of behavior as being either good or bad, good or evil, and then you deal with that with a system of reward and punishment. And so our culture is Judeo-Christian in background. So that's just really ingrained in us as a culture, is that this is good, this is bad, and you reward this and you punish that, rather than the Buddhist worldview and the more Eastern worldview, which is of enlightenment and delusion. This is these people are deluded, you know, and they should be enlightened. And so, you know, what I see, and I've been, you know, I've tried to engage in discussion. Hey, maybe you shouldn't burn that picnic table from that small business while you're protesting, and you're a racist and you're just a bootlicker. And, you know, I've gotten, you know, I've, believe me, I've gotten it from all ends, you know. So people are just going to overreact because the pendulum swings one way and then sometimes it just swings too far the other way. But things do need to swing. They do need to change. But I try to engage with people, and because, you know, the same people that will call for that actress or whoever to be canceled are the same people that their Aunt Betty said the same damn thing. And you still are going to go to Thanksgiving dinner and thank her for the pie. So, you know, it's just a matter of, are we going to engage with people? People have changed. Robert Byrd changed. George Wallace even changed. General Westmoreland changed. So people can change. And how do they change? They can't change if we put them on an island somewhere. So this is a really good discussion. Thank you.
I'm really glad you mentioned that, Soon. One of the things that this past year has helped me understand is the practice of metta, and that goal of trying to extend your sphere of metta as far as you can. But it's also taught me to observe where my own limits are and to extend metta to the people that I can, but no farther. Mm-hmm. And if I can extend metta to my racist aunt, then I will do that. But I may not have the energy to extend my metta to rich Hollywood people who are making plenty of money. And that's, I think that's okay. Like, I can acknowledge their humanity and see the Buddha. I can have faith in someone's Buddha nature, but I may not have the energy to, I may not have energy to dedicate to bringing out that Buddha nature. But I'm trying to make my peace with it. And it's not easy, but I'm trying.
Okay. Any last comments you'll regret not having said? Well, thank you, everyone. I will close with our dedication. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita. Thank you all for being here and for being you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.